Sayoob Bajwani, who runs as well as established the New American Leaders Project, which is actually one of the most interesting and I think effective organizations in the U.S. that is actually training people from immigrant backgrounds who are American citizens to run for office. And she does it in different states around the country. She also was the first Commissioner of Immigrant Affairs for New York City under Mayor Bloomberg. I'm going to follow with Julia Preston, who's going to moderate this and set the context. Julia Preston is currently a contributing writer at the Marshall Project, which focuses predominantly on criminal justice issues. But we all know her as one of the most effective and strategic and, I would say, nuanced reporters that worked at the New York Times and worked on immigration. She never held back and always covered the issue from both sides. And we really are amazingly privileged to have you today to talk about this. And we also understand that this is, you are here as an interested bystander. You're not here as a reporter, and you're not going to be covering this. You're going to be more moderating it, and we really appreciate that. Finally, Ali Noorani, who is the author of There Goes the Neighborhood, which is an interesting book by any means, but really goes into depth about what he's seen as he went around the country, but more so because of what he's done as the executive director at the National Immigration Forum. The forum has been one of Carnegie's longest-term grantees. We've actually funded it back in the 90s. Carnegie actually has worked on immigration reform efforts and funded it, unfortunately, almost 17 years. And we one day we'll see immigration reform happen, and we were hopeful it will happen soon. Ali has, under his leadership, has really taken the forum for what it stands for, which is a right-to-left coalition, and has developed relationships with folks from law enforcement, business, the faith community, and particularly evangelicals. It's a very thoughtful leadership, one of the most effective ones in the nonprofit immigration field, and we're really proud to support you. So for that, that was one of the nicest things I've said to Ali in a long time, by the way, but we are going to turn it over to Julia. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for hosting this the conversation. I started covering immigration for the New York Times in 2006. And every year that I covered immigration for the New York Times, there were major polls of public opinion in the United States about what to do about immigration reform and undocumented immigration. And pretty much consistently through the 10 years that I covered this issue, the polls would show, if you asked the question in a relatively neutral way, what would you do about undocumented people in the United States? Would you give them a path to citizenship? Would you give them legal status but no citizenship? Or would you deport all of them? And throughout that 10-year period, pretty much consistently, two-thirds of Americans in those polls said they would give undocumented people a path to citizenship. And the portion of people who said that they would deport all undocumented immigrants was in the 17-18% range. Sometimes it went up over 20%. If you broke it down by Republicans versus Democrats, the Republicans, there were many more Republicans who were in favor of deportation. Nevertheless, there was a consistent opinion in favor of giving a path to citizenship to undocumented immigrants, and that percentage actually increased in 2016, right before the election. There were a lot of polls that showed that there was an increase. So, needless to say, there's something that Americans who answered those polls are not telling the pollster about what they think about immigration. That sentiment, that view, that policy statement in that my 10 years of covering this issue never became politically effective. And in the same 10 years that I covered the issue, immigration reform failed in 2006, it failed in 2007, the DREAM Act failed in 2010, it failed again in 2014 after the Senate passed the bill. So there is something out there in the United States on immigration that these polls are not showing and that has not been activated politically. And so this is not a discussion about polling. This is a discussion about Ali Noorani, who I think at a very crucial moment in this debate understood this, that there was, you know, even though all the polling and all the right thinking seemed to be on the side of immigration reform, in fact, there was this very large constituency out there in the United States of people who felt threatened by this, who didn't identify with these either the people who were going to be the beneficiaries of the reform. There was some feeling of uncertainty and fear and concern out there that people who were in favor of immigration reform were not connecting with. And as Jerry described, pretty much single-handedly, he forged a very interesting strategy to try and understand a whole set of actors in American political life who had not been a part of the immigration debate. And that was something, you know, I kind of followed Ollie around and wrote some of the stories of the people that he was engaging, and they were always really very good stories of, you know, of people in unexpected places who were coming to a position in favor of not so much of maybe the policy of immigration reform, but of a positive view of the contribution of immigration to the United States. And that kind of raised the whole question of immigration as a cultural battle, which is the way that Ollie has phrased that. And then Sayu has created, from the beginning, her organization, she conceived of a strategy which has to do with empowering people, immigrants at the local and state level to get involved in running for office, you know, getting involved in the political system from the ground up, which is also, I mean, arguably, it's become clear as a result of the election this year how potentially significant that strategy could be. Nevertheless, where we are now is that the United States has a president who has articulated a nativist view. He has a very negative it's not just a policy issue. It's a negative worldview about what immigrants could bring to the United States. He's pretty much repudiated a whole narrative that a century worth of narrative about innovation and the wealth of the cultural wealth that American society acquires through immigration. So my question, broad question today for these two people is going to be, okay, did you fail? Did you fail? Was this a failing strategy? So, just to get the conversation off to a rollicking start. But I think we should start by letting Ollie talk about the strategy that he adopted.
Thank you, Julia, and thank you, Jerry. And I want to thank the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Corporation, Open Society, the Roosevelt Institute, and the New American Leaders Project and the New York Philanthropy for co-sponsoring this morning and pulling together such a great group. Jerry has been a friend, critic, an ally, a friend of the organization where I am now, the organization where I was before, but also personally. And thank you, Jerry. And Julia is a person that I've just come to respect. I remember first talking to Julia in New Bedford, Massachusetts, after a very large immigration raid, and it was like 300 immigrants had been detained and put into deportation proceedings, and we were helping organize a relief operation, and I get the phone calls like, this is Julia Preston from the New York Times. Like, whoa. This is Julia Preston. Wow. So it was, but I really come to admire and respect Julia's work, her critique of both sides of this issue, of our work, just a great, great person. And then I blame Sayu actually for all the work that went into this, because she was the one that said, you know what, you should write a book about, you know, you should interview 5 people and write a book about it. So I interviewed 60 people and wrote a book about it. Really, I admire everything that Sayu is doing at New American Leaders Project. And then Felicia Wong, who is in Canada today at a speaking engagement at the Roosevelt Institute, just does incredible work on economic justice and other issues. So thank you. This strategy and the work is really a function of a lot of conversations and a lot of incredible people. And those incredible people begin with the incredible staff at the National Immigration Forum. Jacinta Ma and Joanna Taylor are here from the forum. The board of directors at the forum, who not just took a gamble on hiring an outsider from D.C. to replace Frank Sherry, but also took a gamble in terms of understanding there was a fundamentally different way that we needed to do, that we needed to operate in the immigration space. So I wanted to read a couple of things from the book. One was that moment in December of 2010 when the DREAM Act failed and was defeated. And then I wanted to also read a little bit from an interview that I did in South Carolina. And then we can kind of launch into it. A little context here. And this is the lead up to the December 2010 DREAM Act vote. And the context here is that this is March 21st, 2010, when the Reform Immigration for America campaign, the campaign that the forum chaired at that point, had put about 250,000 immigrants and their allies on the National Mall. 3 days later, on March 21st, 2010, our rally took place. Over 200,000 immigrants and their supporters gathered on the National Mall for what we billed the March for America. It was a show of force that exceeded our expectations as throngs of immigrants from across the country proudly waved the American flag. Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Democrat from Illinois, one of the most trusted and revered leaders in the Latino community, mirrored Lieutenant Choi's frustration, Lieutenant Choi, active in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell debate, frustration with the Obama administration. We told the crowd, we've listened quietly, we've asked politely, we've turned the other cheek so many times, our heads are spinning. On the same day, at the other end of the mall, another rally took place. The Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, was up for final consideration. The Tea Party, made up of people confronted by a new America they did not understand and a bill they deeply disliked, marched on the Capitol to express their opposition. At this rally, there were reports of racial insults, spitting at members of Congress, and a level of anger few had ever witnessed. On that day, the immigration and healthcare rallies were polar opposites in every way imaginable. Lawrence Downs of the New York Times described the scene. Kill the bill. It throbbed in the ears like an infection. I escaped it at the other end of the National Mall at a rally that far eclipsed the Tea Party in size, hopefulness, and decency. It's usually best to avoid depicting life in black-white contrast. Not this time. Here were two rallies, one good, one loathsome, one hopeful, one paranoid. One trying to repair how Washington works for all America, one looking to break it so the system can go on failing. Kill the bill. Si se puede. Same beat, different drums. I'll take the one that rings with patience and hope. It sounds more American. The anger at the rally opposing Obamacare was the same anger blocking movement on immigration reform. We thought we could defeat this anger through political power, so we didn't try to understand it. We didn't realize how widespread it was or where it was coming from. We felt the immigration movement's electoral influence should lead to federal legislation, just like it had for healthcare. Whether or not we said it, we felt that if we tried to understand the anger, we were validating the anger. We were wrong. And the second thing I want to read is, in South Carolina, of the, like I said, 60 folks that I interviewed, there were a number of them that, the majority of them were conservative, socially or politically conservative. One of the people that I interviewed was Harold Smith, lives in Spartanburg, South Carolina, owned a small business owner, sells insurance, born and raised in South Carolina. Harold Smith, a lifelong resident of Spartanburg County, is a white Southerner who grew up during segregation, experienced integration, and described the changes that led to a new South Carolina as a place where, quote, the world came to us. In what was clearly his recliner, Smith fidgeted as we watched the returns of the 2016 Super Tuesday primaries. The steady click of the rocking recliner was the metronome to his Southern accent. We just finished an informal family dinner where grandparents doted, parents talked, and grandkids cried and played. Smith's mother sat on the couch nearby, and his son Derek sat on another recliner across the room. Harold told me stories of his childhood in South Carolina and life through desegregation. He didn't sugarcoat the tension and tragedies of the time, nor did he delve deeply into what was underneath those experiences. He told me, I do remember going to the water fountain and seeing white and colored. I remember that as a little kid, I must have been 8 or 9 years old. As a kid, you don't know. You kind of learn it's like, oh, maybe they've got something that we don't need to get rubbed off on us. It was not spoken, though. It wasn't spoken like we hate them or we're against them. It was just like, oh, you stay away from those folks. His was a simple life, he told me, really simple. We were sort of protected, but I do remember watching the news and seeing the violence, thinking, what is going on? These days, Smith lives in a gated subdivision where he fishes on a small lake just off his backyard deck. And over time, he realized how the changes around him impacted the way he saw the world. The bubble he grew up in was not impenetrable. That's why I say, one of my sayings is, my dad was less prejudiced than his dad, I'm less prejudiced than my dad, and my children are less prejudiced than me, and their children will be less prejudiced than them. Harold grew up in a South Carolina that was black and white and governed by whites. Now the Palmetto State is black, white, and brown, and until very recently, it was governed by a South Asian. All things considered, South Carolina's economy has been stable, but the identity of the state has not been. While Americans of Harold's generation have seen a lot, today's changes are coming fast and they're coming loudly. So in his living room with CNN flickering in the background, I asked Harold where he thought today's racial and cultural tension was coming from. He rocked in his recliner for one extra beat and said, I think it's the political correctness. I knew my grandpa. He didn't own any slaves. My dad didn't own any slaves. I didn't own any slaves. Somehow I owe somebody something. Nobody in my family ever owned a slave, but somehow I feel like I'm blamed for it. What are your needs? Your needs are the same as mine. Let's get up and go to work. I don't quite understand, as his voice trailed off. I don't know. There wasn't any anger in Harold's voice. There was confusion, frustration, and pain, but not anger. Just like how he hoped his grandchildren would be better people, less prejudiced than him, Harold wanted to make sure his family prospered. Demographic change and racial equality weren't necessarily a threat to him, but they were points of confusion. And to help him address this question, even as a supporter of immigration reform, he felt his best choice for president was Donald Trump. So did we fail? Yes and no. I think that we have not failed because the strategy that we describe in this book and the strategy that as the National Immigration Forum has moved forward with is completely useless and ineffective without the strategy of increasing the political power of the immigrant community and of the allies who care about these issues. So in that way, I don't think we failed because we wouldn't be at this point without that base. Where we have failed is that we have ignored, you know, the literal and the geographic and the political middle of the country. We've assumed the worst of people, and we haven't assumed that folks just want to be engaged in the conversation. So since 2011, what we've done is really try to establish this network of relationships with faith, law enforcement, business leaders, and the network has come to be known as Bibles, Badges, and Business for Immigration Reform. And personally, I think it's, you know, number one, the most interesting thing that I will ever do, but it's also been the easiest thing that I will ever do. Because what we have found is that time and again, folks just wanted to be a part of the conversation. They wanted to sit across the table with somebody and say, and have that person or that organization listen to them and not feel like they were being blamed for all of society's tension. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's always easy or it's always fun. It's oftentimes awkward and kind of and very challenging. But our unofficial motto as an organization is that we want to meet people where they are. We just don't want to leave them there. And so I think in some ways the movement has succeeded, and in other ways we have fallen short.
So you're dealing not at the federal level, but mainly state and local. So is there a different feeling, do you think, at state and local level in terms of the way the immigration debate is going?
Well, not now. I mean, now I think we're unified around a singular enemy, right? And I'd say I feel like I've lost my opportunity to give thanks, so I'll just give a quick thanks. I think as an organization, we did not fail. We had a 67% win rate. So of our alum who ran for office, 67% won their races. And of those who ran for city council and state legislatures, 50% beat incumbents. And often they, these are all new Americans, right? Some of whom were formerly undocumented, some of whom have, you know, quote, Muslim-sounding last names. They all beat, and in the case of those who beat incumbents, it was also all white incumbents, some men, some women. So I give that example both because I'm boasting about our organization, but also because I think that there is this constant tension that I think happened in the election postmortem about, you know, was this an indictment of demographic change in our country, right? And I think that, sure, that is true. And I've often said in settings that, you know, the election, those who chose Donald Trump also chose to ignore multiple identities of mine personally, right? So it's hard not to be angry about that or frustrated about that. But I do think that it was an indictment of politics as usual, that is a significant part of people choosing Donald Trump. In part of what the example that Ali gives about Harold, it's not so much that people saw him as a solution, but they saw him as an alternative. And, you know, we can wring our hands about why people didn't see behind the scenes or beyond the headlines, but the reality is that most people don't spend their time thinking at that level about politics. I want to share with you a quote also from 2003 that I pulled up because, Ali, in your book, you mentioned Richard Longworth talking about this notion of a hormonal strategy. So in the
you may want to give some context.
Yeah. Do you want to give the context for that? And then I'll follow up with my quote.
Dick Longworth wrote a book, Caught in the Middle, about the Midwest and how the Midwest was caught in the middle of globalization. It's actually one of the books that when I read, I was like, huh, there's something else going on here. So I interviewed Dick in Chicago in February last year, and just as Trump and kind of talking about walls, and the line that he gave, to paraphrase, was that, you know, Trump can build as many walls as he wants, no wall can stand in the way of hormones, meaning that the country will continue to become more diverse even if we close off the country from immigration.
And it made me think about being at a House subcommittee hearing on immigration in 2003 when I was Commissioner of Immigrant Affairs. And at the time, we in New York City were revisiting an executive order that was going to protect confidentiality of immigration status. And the House subcommittee called us in and there was a hearing, and Chris Cannon, representative from Utah, who has now been replaced by Chaffetz, I guess. In the quote that I pulled up, and I'm not going to read the whole quote, but there's this tension that many folks in government are experiencing around knowing that we cannot deport eleven million folks, but also not wanting to face the reality of what it meant to provide a pathway to citizenship. And in this quote, he says, you know, with that many illegal aliens, it means we either become a police state and start kicking down doors, and heaven help us if your daughter marries a Mendoza or a Martinez, because then she's going to become the focus of that kind of police action. And look, all these things are up to our own interpretation, but I remember that quote because I remember sitting in that room and thinking that there is this great fear of this miscegenation, right? And what does it mean to have your daughter be gay or be married to an immigrant? Then the conversation changes, and not necessarily in a way that you want it to change, but you have to face that reality. And I think we are in a moment where nobody knows what to do about that. And I think the book reflects that. I think the conversations that we have on the other side, if you will, with people who are immigrants and are experiencing this, there is not a single person I have met, and this is the last thing I'll say, who feels that the election of Trump was a surprise. That is in the new American community, right? Most people were shocked, but they were not surprised. And that is because this tension between being embraced, if you will, or at best tolerated as an immigrant, but having, so you as the individual are not necessarily the object of hatred, but the policy, the immigration policy, is a very, very fraught conversation. That is a tension that I think we've all experienced. I think the one thing that there are many silver linings to Donald Trump's election, but in our case, we've obviously seen a huge, huge uptick in applications, but particularly applications from people who have clearly identified a race they want to run for. Tomorrow morning, I'm headed to Detroit. We trained there 2 years ago. At that time, 16% of our participants were from American Muslim communities and South Asian communities. Tomorrow, the room is going to be 47% Arab American, South Asian, or other American Muslim, and also an increase in the number of Black Muslims in general applying for our trainings. So I think the one difference between 2003, which was post September 11th, and now is that we are not intimidated. I think we do understand the power, that the demographic power that we have. I don't think we've understood fully how to build enough political power across immigrant groups and across some, I'll say, issue divides, not just partisan divides, but issue divides, because there are issue divides within the immigrant community. I don't think we've fully understood how to leverage that demographic power into political power.
So, Ali, I was struck by the fact that the opening passages of your book, you set up this scenario with the conflict between the push for immigration reform in the first 2 years of the Obama administration and the ACA. But the other thing that was happening right then was the worst recession since the Great Depression. And the administration was not only consumed with the ACA, but they had also passed a stimulus, they'd saved the auto industry. And so I'm wondering if, looking back from this, the perspective of the election, if you feel like there's also been some kind of gap there in terms of the immigrants and the immigrant rights movement, addressing American workers where they are actually in terms of the uncertainty, not so much a cultural uncertainty, but an actual jobs uncertainty.
Right, and economic anxiety.
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, frankly, one of the big reasons that we as an organization really doubled down on the idea of engaging the faith community is that, with all due respect to those organizations that do great work in the business community, we felt that the message coming from business leadership was not going to be the one that convinced, that opened the minds of economically anxious and worried Americans, because, you know, oftentimes what would happen is that we'd roll out the big CEO in 2006 and 7, or, you know, Tom Donohue from the Chamber of Commerce, and what that would trigger on the part of the voter who is worried of whether or not they're going to be able to hold on to their house is that they would say, well, can I hold on to my house if there's an immigrant coming to take my job? I do think that we have not approached the business case the right way, and I think that's changing now. I think that, you know, folks at New American Economy, Forward.us, and others across the country are doing incredible work to lift up and bring a different perspective to the business case. But we skipped over it. And I guess the other piece of this is that we looked at this not as an economic policy issue, but as a social policy issue. Because, you know, the way that people's, you know, lives are changing in their neighborhoods, yes, it has a lot to do with jobs and the economy, but it also has to do with the fact that the person moving in next door, even the person moving in one town over, doesn't look or sound like them. So last summer, one of the studies that I cited was that last summer it was a Gallup survey that was released that looked at why Trump voters were voting for Trump. What they found is that the sample of Trump voters, and this is a sample of, what, 30,000 people, economically better off than most Republicans. Jobs are protected from the ups and downs of trade. They live in culturally isolated communities. But the trigger for them was that they voted for Trump because they didn't think that their kids would do better than them. So there's a lot to unpack there. And I just felt like, I feel like that we have failed in that we always thought, well, business is going to solve the problem. Business is only one of a number of messages, not just messages, but points of contact for people as they're grappling with this.
Well, one thing I would just say about that is I do think that that American policymakers have really failed to themselves grapple with the role of America in a changing global order. Like, it's just we're in denial that things have changed. And so we sort of engage in the same tactics. And so if we, and I say we more broadly as American policy, speaking from a standpoint of American policymakers, if we don't acknowledge that, it's very difficult then to acknowledge the trickle-down effect on the average American. And I also find it ironic that immigrants come here looking for a better life, continue to come here looking for a better life at a time when Americans who have, who are say third or fourth generation are grappling with not having the life that they want. So in terms of a shared value argument, there is something there to be developed, that we're all looking for the same thing, but it's elusive for everyone.
Well, so let me follow up on that. So what was very powerful about Donald Trump's message was his evocation of a failing America, of an America that is not great, that was great but is not great now. This very dark view, this sort of dark view is not limited to immigrants. It was the whole society,
yeah,
that he said, you know, this has gone off the rails and I'm the one who's going to bring this back. So my question to you is, you just told us that your people have had considerable success in their races. So what is their message? What has been the successful message among your candidates who run for office?
So I think the most fundamental thing that they've done right is actually talk to voters, mm-hmm, and connected to voters. And I know that sounds overly simplistic. No, but
now,
I mean,
there's,
I think,
an idea.
Yeah, I think knocking on doors and talking to people does help to, it also helps to beat incumbents, because incumbents often take those voters for granted, right? And I think also expanding the electorate to include new and low propensity voters. I mean, when you hear about the numbers coming out of Arizona in terms of new registered Latinos, it wasn't the Democratic Party that was registering those voters. It's groups that were funded by Carnegie Corporation and Ford and others who were themselves have a vested interest in getting Latinos to turn out and vote, are the ones who are doing that. I mean, they're the ones getting those field workers. Like when I knocked on doors with our candidates in my free time during my volunteer time, or when we, you know, the minimum wage campaign, all of those things that were happening in Arizona that were mobilizing an electorate, not just for the presidentials, but around all the other races, that was all being led by nonprofit groups, right? And so I think the parties themselves have really failed to acknowledge that there is a changing electorate to which they can tap in. And I think this thing about, I mean, the one other thing I will say, and we talked a little bit about this on the phone, again, to this postmortem of the election, like all we're talking about now is this group of white working class, and we're not even talking about the white working class and what they need from policymakers. We're talking about the white working class as a political constituency that can be mobilized. So in that, we fail to do what we're talking about, which is really understand what these folks need. And in that, we also fail to acknowledge that the working class is more diverse than just white. And frankly, you know, I think that there were a lot of closeted Trump supporters, even on like our Facebook feeds, right? Our high school friends, young people I worked with when I ran a youth organization in Queens, who have now sort of outed themselves and in ways that refer to some of these things you're talking about. It's like, well, you know, when I go to the supermarket checkout line, you know, the person ahead of me is buying salmon with their food stamps, but I can't afford to do that on my police officer salary. Or friends who, you know, they're not my friends, they're friends of my in-laws and my parents. And it's just like, we want to change. These are all brown people that we're talking about. So I feel like by focusing on the white working class, we ignore the fact that there are also many, many brown people who supported Donald Trump, maybe not enough to win him the election, but also felt that they wanted change. And we ignore the realities of what the white working class is going through by just saying, oh, we're going to target them as a political constituency, right? Like, it's like, oh, soccer moms, white working class, Latinos.
So, Ollie, the conservatives who you worked with, I'm sure there were quite a number of Trump voters among them. And so when they see you after the election, what do they say?
So Harold called me the night, two nights after the election, kind of give you his perspective. So he calls me up and I see his numbers, like, huh, this is gonna be fun. But he says, hey, what do you think? I said, well, Harold, you're right. And I said, you know, you're right. There's something happening out there in the country and that we didn't totally understand. And I said, Harold, you know, I'm worried about what he's going to do in the immigration space. And Harold says, oh, don't worry. He was making a deal. Right? It's just, you know, he was just getting votes. I said, okay, Harold. But if things go sideways, if Trump follows through on these campaign promises, you're going to be the one that has to stop him. And Harold paused and he said, I know. So even at that moment, 2 days after the election, I think in this one case, he understood that, you know, his guy, Republicans, were in charge, but it came with a lot of responsibility. And then something even more recent, I was in Idaho 2 weeks ago in a room of 75 dairymen, at least half of whom voted for Trump for one reason or another. And getting to the economic question, Idaho is 4% unemployment. In this particular part of Idaho, it's 3% unemployment. So it is a tight labor market. And this room is just angry because their workers are terrified to go to show up. They're terrified to leave their home. And they don't look at their workers just as folks who are kind of turning the wheels of their dairies. A lot of these workers have been with that farm for 5, 10, if not more years. So it's just this level of anger of, okay, you know, this isn't what I signed up for. So, but our message was exactly the same. It's like, okay, yes, this is happening. How are you going to pressure your congressional delegation, the president, to change what? To change tack? I'm not sure we're at the tipping point where Republicans who voted for Donald Trump are ready to kind of take that next step and be really outspoken. But what we've found is that whether it's the faith, the law enforcement, the business community, there is a growing sense of, okay, we have an opportunity, we also have a responsibility to, you know, urge our members, our administration, to lead and to govern. We'll see how far we get.
I'm going to go back to you with a question. So your essential argument in the book is that this is really a cultural battle that you have to kind of address the legitimate cultural concerns that people have in a changing society and not dismiss them as being racist or. Not dismissing those people as being unreachable by your approach.
Absolutely.
My question is, is that too slow? Is it too slow a strategy? Does it need? I mean, when you look at where we're at now,
one of the coalitions that we helped establish is the Evangelical Immigration Table, and to a person around the table this is a coalition of your leading evangelical organizations in the nation. They can, you know, if they put their full weight behind something, they can reach 30, 40, 50 million people. And they said, you know, at that first meeting, I remember distinctly, I said, in order to get to where we are now in 2011 to where we want to be, it'll be at least 7 years. And I'm like, had your reaction. I was like, well, no, we can't do that. We're not waiting 7 years. Barack Obama's president. We're going to get this done. That didn't work out. Yeah, it is slower. Oh, it is slower, but I'm not sure we have a choice because, you know, a lot of us in the room will say demographics is destiny. You know, eventually the country will be so diverse that policy change will be much easier. I'm not sold on that. New York and California and Illinois will be more diverse, but if you're an immigrant living in Oklahoma, you're very worried. So that's why I think in the Midwest, the Southeast, the Mountain West, you have to engage in a cultural strategy so that conservative and moderate white America see immigrants and immigration as a net benefit to themselves personally and to their families. And you don't do that based on an argument that talks about changing demographics, changing politics, or changing policy. You do that by talking to folks of how their culture may be changing, how they feel their values may be changing, and if they are, why? If they're not, why? And make the case that, you know, immigrants and refugees are coming to the U.S. They're changing just as much as anybody else. It's the ongoing, you know, American identity crisis that ultimately, yes, will result in policy change. But to jam through policy change based on the hope of changing demographics, A, has failed, and B, even if there's a slight chance of being successful, I think it's a really tough recipe for the country moving forward.
So your strategy has been political power from grassroots from the beginning.
Right.
And so where do you see that now? I mean, is that too slow?
I mean, it's slow. But it's the only alternative that I can think about. And I, you know, actually, when I had the idea for the organization was in July of 2008, and you were seated at the head of a table in DC, and we were talking about what were we going to do with a new Congress and a new president. And I remember thinking in that same meeting that we are talking about the same strategies that failed in 06 and 07, that we're still talking about how do we mobilize Congress. And so at that time, the idea behind the organization was to build local and state power as a pipeline to Congress, because as slow as the strategy is, I think we have to change who we're talking to. We in the immigrant rights movement tend to blame ourselves. Like, our field was wrong, our comms was wrong, sorry, you know, because then we get the resources for it and we try to do it. But a lot of the problem is who we're talking to. And until those people don't change, and it will take time. I mean, these people have to die out before they're going to get out of Congress. And so, I mean, that's literally what's going to happen. There's no term limits. And I will, just to follow up on the point that Ali made about talking to folks about changing culture. You know, I have come to the conclusion that it's very important to maintain an open conversation. But ultimately, people are not going to talk to you and give you respect until you have power. And so this, yes, it's a slow strategy, but as far as I can tell, it's the only strategy to create the kind of space that we need to make policy that's going to work for a diverse group of Americans. And so you asked me earlier the message that our candidates had was that I am going to go into office and fight for you. And it doesn't matter whether you are a white school teacher or you are a formerly undocumented Latino security guard, or whether you're the parent of schools in a failing school system. I convinced you that I was going to be the person that was going to fight on your behalf. And that's why, and I asked you for your vote. And so that created the change. And in Arizona, in particular, in one district where two of our female alum won a state legislative seat, so Arizona has clean elections. Go with me on this slightly wonky route. So they both ran a clean election campaign against an incumbent.
Clean election
is a publicly financed campaign by either the state or the municipal entity. And in Arizona, I won't get into all the details, but basically, if you run for a state leg seat and you agree to file as a clean election candidate, then you get, I think it's $25,000 from the state to run your campaign, and you can't raise any additional money. And you have to raise a little bit of money locally, et cetera. But the major point is that The state classifies these districts as leaning Democrat, Democrat, leaning Republican, Republican. And the two alum who won in that district, which was a district that's that is classified or was classified as leaning Democrat. The party, the local party, didn't really take them seriously. They're two women of color. And because they won the race, all of a sudden, then, the district started to be viewed differently, right? Because suddenly now they've registered new voters, and those voters are voted Democrat. And so now there's a sea change that occurred simply because these two candidates decided to go ahead and run anyway. And you see this in multiple cases where incumbents ran, where the party then starts to view the district differently. And that's what I mean about until we have power, people are just going to see us as a bunch of numbers, like numbers that are going to turn out to vote for their candidate, whoever that is. And so I know it's a long-term strategy, but I'm not sure that there's any other way. And the last thing I'll say about demographics is I always say this, that the reason that I know that demographics is not destiny is because women have been 50% of the population.
Right, exactly.
And look at where we are in 2017 in terms of women's representation. So we cannot believe that more Latinos and more Asian Americans and more African immigrants are going to have power unless there's a very determined, intentional strategy to build that power.
Yeah. I'll just add one quick thing is one of the most fun chapters that I wrote was about Houston. Houston is now the most diverse city in the country. Harris County is top five most diverse counties in the country. It's, you know, Harris County on its own is bigger than, you know, a handful of states in the nation. But what I did is I interviewed folks in Sugar Land, Texas, which is a wealthy suburb of Texas, very large Asian and South Asian population, and about 25 miles to the east, I went to Pasadena, Texas, which is about 60% Latino, 40% white. And then I talked to a couple of people in Houston proper as well. But it was the same thing that Sai was talking about, is that there was this effort by, you know, the immigrant community or folks, you know, who are children of immigrants to really integrate into greater Houston, become U.S. citizens, but then run for office. And then understanding of how their runs for office changed their roles within the community, how the Voting Rights Act decision just, you know, torpedoed what was happening. Amazing things are happening in Pasadena. But then ultimately, you know, I interviewed David Fleming, who is a senior pastor at a Forest Baptist Church, a 13,000-person congregation north Houston, white, wealthy. And what he did is that he saw his community changing, and he said, okay, instead of us having a separate Hispanic ministry, we're going to integrate our entire church, and the Hispanic ministry will be part of the white ministry. And he hired Hispanics to be on his senior staff. So in that one kind of like 3 or 4 day jaunt, it was just this incredible like combination of changing demographics, political power, and then really intense and difficult cultural change in Texas. I guess in closing, I would say that I left this project with, yes, a sense of, okay, we've got a lot of work to do, but there's actually a lot of hope from these different perspectives as well.
All right, so I'm going to open it up for questions, and if you could just identify yourself before you ask your question.
Hi, I'm Robert Nolan, Director of Communications here at Carnegie Corporation of New York. Thank you so much for your book, Ali, and for all three of you for speaking today. My question, not surprisingly, is about communications. I came in a little late, and I heard you talking about some of the messaging strategy that you've deployed nationwide. And I wanted to ask a little bit more about the messengers. I know, you know, you're working closely with the evangelical community to reach conservatives on immigration issues. I know there's also been efforts to reach, you know, law enforcement officials and leaders in the business community. But so my question is, how unified are the messages that those three groups are putting out on a national scale? And have you considered, or are you considering, any other sort of more novel approaches that might reach audiences, say, for example, I don't know, NASCAR or other sort of other areas, sports that might penetrate sure, with some of these conservative voters?
A lot of the entire coalition, the entire network was set up so that, you know, it was the messenger articulating a message that resonated with a very specific audience. And honestly, one of the more disconcerting parts about writing this book is that this was really one of the first times in as long as I've been at the forum with the strategy where we were really, you know, putting forth our voice. And that's why the book itself relies on other people's voices so heavily. During the Obama administration, there was certainly more alignment between the different constituencies on message. At this point, there's difference because every constituency is looking at these issues through a very specific prism. They're feeling their own set of pressures on the ground, and they all have a very different relationship with the administration and Congress at this point. Sometimes look at the question of, okay, the message that's coming out of the center-right community that we're working with, how is it aligned with folks on the left? Over the course of the Obama administration, the language may have been different, but the policy goals were by and large the same. I think that holds to a large degree currently, mainly because right now, I think even if for our conservative faith law enforcement business leaders, they feel under such intense pressure just from a moral perspective, a security perspective, or even economic perspective, that there is some alignment. In terms of other constituents, so that's, I mean, I guess to answer your question quickly is like, yes, there is alignment, but not as much as there was in the past. Other constituencies we've thought about, we're starting to do more work with veterans, both who are new Americans themselves or served with new Americans. We've dabbled a little bit in kind of the sports world. Kind of gets expensive and complicated quickly. But I think veterans will be the place where we want to try to develop some more expertise.
Hi, thank you very much, both of you. I'm Elspeth Revere, recently retired from the MacArthur Foundation and just visiting in New York right now. I'm wondering whether the National Immigration Forum has a short-term strategy as well as the long-term one you've been talking about.
That's a great question. Our short-term strategy at this point is to do a few things. One is to explain to the relationships that we've built over the last few years is that these are the consequences of these executive orders. These are the consequences of this legislation that is being developed. So it's very educational. And Jacinta and her policy team do daily work with the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force, with the Evangelical Immigration Table, so that people, and the most amazing part about this moment for us as an organization is that even in such a high stakes, polarized, intense environment, folks still trust us. And that means that sometimes, like, the most important thing we say as the forum is what we don't say. And we have to be really careful what we're asking for folks. So our short-term strategy number one is to educate the center-right network that we built. Number two is to then, as issues are moving forward, either to improve them on the Hill or to boggle them up. And third is to do everything we can to put forward a constructive narrative, meaning that at every moment we can, we're like the Idaho example. We tried to make sure that, if national press are looking for a story about conservatives who are engaging in this issue in a constructive way, it's like, hey, call up Bob Narabout, my board member who runs the Idaho Dairymen Association. So that's a short-term strategy that has a long-term implication as well.
Hi, I'm Alex Rojas with Tides, and I was just following up to the question. We support a lot of the groups under the Alliance for Citizenship, mm-hmm. and I'm just curious how the forum or others are working together to also address there are issues and sometimes conflicts and tensions in the strategies themselves, yep. right? So how you're sure. working together to move that forward in a more strategic way. And I'm also curious because I felt I was left in a cliffhanger when you first came out.
That's why you should read the book.
When you talked about validating the anger and how we were wrong, what are some of the lessons learned from that particular moment that you're looking to apply?
Sure. So, the Alliance for Citizenship is a coalition of immigrant rights organizations, both in D.C. but also nationally, who are really approaching these issues from a power-building perspective. I write in the book that when we started this strategy in 2011 and 12, we had to spend a good year explaining to our colleagues on the left of, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it. And, a lot of the folks who supported us had questions, because they got questions from other organizations that they were funding. The case that we made then and the case that we make now is that as an organization, as the National Immigration Forum, our mission hasn't changed. Our principles haven't changed. We're going to be just as hard on Republicans as we are on Democrats. And we're going to maybe use a slightly different language, and we'll use a different strategy. So we're not at that table necessarily, but we're always in communication with the traditional immigrant rights organizations. In terms of kind of validating the anger versus ignoring it, that's a biggest part of that has been to hire staff who are comfortable in those conversations. So we've got about 20 people in D.C. do policy work and communications work. Across the country, we've got another 15 folks. I would say half of them work with businesses on integration issues, and half of them work to implement the Bibles Badges business strategy. Each one of our Bibles Badges business organizers come from that community. They come from the faith community. A number of them themselves are, you know, Southern Baptist pastors. Our law enforcement person has a long history of working with law enforcement officials, either directly or through associations. Our person with veterans himself did worked in veterans affairs issues with the Bush administration. So we try not to hire people who are kind of like your political operative. We try to hire people who really have the relationships and can be the interpreter.
I'll just say one thing about the Alliance is that that's where, so we're not really working with them on a regular basis, but that's where we get information that, you know, about things that are coming down the pike that we can then promote to social media and through our network of alumni and elected officials. So it's a resource for us more than a place where we engage.
Yes, Jer.
Thank you very much. So I just wanted to, first of all, I forgot to mention this morning, I often wake up from emails from Ali, so just FYI. He's very prolific. But he did say one this morning.
I'm just very communicative.
You're very communicative. But this one was particularly interesting because it showed that Lou Dobbs has actually endorsed his book and suggested it as a must-read. So we are getting somewhere, I guess, where you have Lou Dobbs as one of your endorsers, but who was very anti-immigration several years ago but has moved a little bit on that score. But I actually wanted to ask you, because you both raised the structural, there's structural barriers that I think that are really hard, one of which is the political, which Sayu alluded to. I mean, you have the Hell No Caucus, which is the Freedom Caucus, which, you know, they would not approve anything, even what this president wants to do, because they don't necessarily believe it's conservative enough. And they have blocked all the immigration bills, a lot of them have, especially in 2014. And so that is really structurally difficult to do because it's related to redistricting. I mean, they're in very safe districts. They don't necessarily, well, they may be there, as you suggest, until they go to their greater good, wherever that is. So that's one. And but there's also structural issues on the economy. I mean, the fact is, with automation, as we're seeing, I mean, it's very unlikely that many of these jobs will come back to some of these places where people are hurting. And that's going to impact, as you suggest, you know, working class people across race and ethnicity, including white African Americans, et cetera. You know, unless you really change some of the structural economic issues where social mobility comes back, you know, it's going to be really hard to convince people that, you know, things are going to do well for them. I'm just curious, as you think about both, you know, how do we deal with the larger issues that nobody seems to want to take on?
I think I'm not sure that this is really an answer to your question, but I'll sort of add to it. I think one, on the political side, I think one of the things that has been interesting to me is the rising number of people interested in running for political office, right? So we see all these people signing up. And I think, you know, I'm not sure what that's really going to mean in terms of winning, right? I think, like, we're talking about House seats that were, not we, but in the political, you know, elite, I guess, these seats that we're going to target, et cetera. I don't know whether we're going to win them. We'll see what happens with John Ossoff's race in Georgia. I think it's possible. No, I mean, I'm saying we as in the country, we'll see what happens because the organization's not involved and neither am I. But I think that mostly I think all this energy around just running for office, signing up to do anything is probably not going to result in anything. However, I do think that we will see some challengers who are kind of, maybe they're Hail Mary passes, but they might end up changing the composition of Congress, or at least tipping certain things. So that doesn't address the structural problem, because really the structural problems are around money and politics and term limits and how do we actually create opportunities for new people to emerge. On the economic side, I think, you know, it goes back to what I said earlier, like, I'm not sure that anybody knows what the heck is going on. And so, like, we can't, one, it's kind of like acknowledging the anger, right? If you don't validate that we have a problem, then you're not trying to find solutions. And so that concerns me greatly. I feel that most people have their head in the sand about the fact that things really have changed. You know, it's sort of like me, yesterday I was at my daughter's middle school transition meeting and these parents are all talking about, well, what is the smartphone policy? And I'm like, people, like, just deal with it. They have smartphones. There's, you know, like, but there's still this tension of like, oh my God, how do I protect my child from a smartphone? And so it's a little bit of that, like, we just don't want to believe that things have changed. And so, you know, I don't know if the Roosevelt folks have anything to, I mean, I know we, you know, there's a lot of conversation at Roosevelt about changing the conversation about the way that we talk about the economy and rewriting not just the rules, but how we think about it. So I don't know if it's, I mean, unless you want to, you have a solution to the economic.
So I would say two things and would love Joel's perspective. One is that even when you look closely at your Freedom Caucus members, immigration will cut in an interesting way there. So you've got Justin Amash, who, House Republican from Michigan, has taken on the administration on a number of issues, and he's great on immigration. Mick Mulvaney, when he was in South Carolina, was great on immigration. I mean, Julia reported a great story about an event with Hispanic pastors in his district.
Not only that, but he did the whole thing in Spanish.
Yep.
He gave, Mick Mulvaney gave a town hall meeting in Gaffney, South Carolina, in which he did not speak a word of English the whole time. He did the whole thing in Spanish. Yeah, yeah, it was quite extraordinary.
When it comes to immigration, it kind of cuts in different ways when you get to the Freedom Caucus in these districts. And some of it's because their districts are changing to some degree. Mm-hmm. Some of it's because we've been able to engage them based on their values and who they see themselves as. I think on the economic question, there's two issues. One is you have what I would call intellectual populism, which is, you know, kind of flat earth economics, and this idea that goods won't move, information won't move, money won't move, and people won't move. It's almost like there's a part of the Republican, not the populist establishment, that says, you know, let's just close the borders and then we're going to be fine. And I just don't think that's sustainable. And then I also think that, you know, frankly, organized labor is really struggling with this issue, especially in the Midwest, because their industries are changing and how they communicate those changes to their membership without conflating trade and immigration is really difficult. I mean, last spring, House leadership was telling us we're getting killed because trade and immigration are being conflated in the eyes of Republican voters. And that's a very difficult narrative to dig out of.
I can add a little bit about work that we've been doing in terms of understanding where the economic conversation needs to go post-election. I think something that was really fascinating to me about some of the focus groups that we actually ended up doing in Macomb County and a number of think tanks did some focus groups looking at Trump country, essentially, was while there was a lot of economic anxiety that was not completely removed from anxieties about people who folks frankly did not understand, as we've been talking about, like this anxiety, we've been calling it a social anxiety. There was a very real political reality that I think is illuminating for anyone who is going to govern, which was that a lot of the top priorities for these voters were not deeply touched by the administration. So they were folks who already had health insurance and were worried about rising costs of premiums, not necessarily about the uninsured rate. Or they were folks who were impacted by trade and did not understand the administration's stance on TPP. Or there were folks who were deeply linked to the veteran community who, you know, felt like there was no movement that had been done on the VA, which all have, you know, roots in economic anxiety, but also had policy implications that had not necessarily been specifically addressed throughout the course of the administration, which I think is important for folks as we're thinking about how do you build a governing strategy that works for folks' economic anxieties but manifests intangible outcomes. And so the idea that, like, saying that jobs are not coming back doesn't have, you know, any legs with folks. You can't say, like, oh, we're just going to bring this abstract concept of clean energy jobs when people are in West Virginia and they're concerned about coal jobs, and those are the ones that are going away. Instead, we have to think about, you know, what are the actual policy levers at this moment that fit a forward-looking economic strategy but also have tangible impacts in folks' day-to-day lives between election cycles.
You talked before about an increase in the number of candidates, people who want to be trained to be candidates since the election. I just wondered if you see any patterns there. Is it a different kind of person that's signing up now, or is it just the numbers have gone up, or geographically is it different?
So we're only on our third training. I don't know that if maybe, I don't know if Marion, you want to respond to that, but I feel like mostly it's just overall. So it's not necessarily more women. It's not, I think the reason I mentioned the American Muslim and broadly MASA community numbers is because there was a time even in the life cycle of the New American Leaders Project, where people from those communities were more concerned about putting themselves out there. And I think that is not the case right now. I think more people are willing to step in and fight on behalf of their communities. And so there's less of a concern about I will be targeted because of my identity, or that concern is being trumped by the concern around the way that communities are being targeted. Marin, do you want to add anything about the applicant pool?
My name is Marin Guerra. I am the program associate at the New American Leaders Project. I've been working with them to organize our trainings for the past 3 years. So really interesting. I think that in terms of the demographics, things have largely been the same. Most of our applicants have been coming from the Asian, South Asian, Latino communities, but we did see a huge shift and a dramatic increase in the Muslim Americans who apply to our training. That has doubled this year, and we've also seen more of our immigrant candidates more unapologetically embrace their identities. So just to elevate what Sayu has said, one candidate in 2016 in Austin, Texas, his name is Sean Hassan, ran for the very first time for a school board seat and ran an ad in a local newspaper that said, "I am Trump's worst nightmare. I am Muslim, South Asian, and living in Texas." And he won and got a share of 80,000 votes. I think those are the shifts that we're seeing that are very exciting this year.
We're about to close out, but I just wanted to ask you something, Julia, because a lot of the things that we need to do is to actually get people to believe us. And there is this moment now when nobody seems to believe anything, even the most authoritative and the best research. How do you think to get people to sort of go understand that facts really do exist? And that if you have any ideas about that from your vantage point.
You're asking me two questions there. One has to do with journalism and the other has to do with immigration. I mean, I think that the best antidote to fake news is news that's not fake. Mm-hmm. And a lot of journalists, I think, particularly in the, you know, I think it's probably not a secret that there are a lot of liberals in mainstream journalism. And so I think a lot of journalists in this period, both because journalism failed so dramatically to understand what was going on in the country and to foresee the results of the election, and also because, you know, now journalism is under attack, and, you know, a certain part of journalism is under attack. A lot of journalists have sort of been asking, should I be in an advocacy situation? Is this kind of balanced journalism that I practice, you know, still the right way to go? And my answer to that would be yes, it is still the right way to go. That, you know, impartial journalism is even more important now than it has been. And so if your question is, you know, how can we use the media to get our message across, the message that we want to convey more effectively, I think that's the wrong question. You know, I mean, I didn't write stories about Mark Shurtleff or about, you know, I didn't go to that town hall meeting in South Carolina because I was, you know, on the side of the National Immigration Forum. I went because it was a really good story. Here's this conservative guy that's meeting in South Carolina who's, you know, meeting, having a town hall with all these Latinos. And it got to be an even better story because he got up there and he said, "I know you want immigration reform, but you're not going to get it this year. We're not going to have immigration reform." This was when immigration reform had been already passed by the Senate. So he didn't, you know, mince words. And so you need a good story. Journalists are looking for good stories. And to think that there'll be some kind of new, you know, sort of either obvious or, you know, clandestine advocacy from the journalism community, I think is a wrong expectation, and, you know, and not something that people should encourage. I really feel like, as I said, you know, more than ever, this is the time when we need good, independent, impartial, and fair journalism.
Can I add something to that?
Why don't we do this? Why don't you, everybody can have 1 minute to say something final words, maybe you guys, and then Joelle's going to have the last word. Oh, do you want to say something?
As part of your final words, can you say something about your sustainability message both to the funding community and to other grassroots? You both spoke about how this is a slow serum IV process. So how to sustain that both, you know, for the folks organizing as well as for those of us who are trying to deliver a message to funders.
Oh, I actually don't know how to answer that question.
I would say just send Sayu more money. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think we are working at NALP. We're really trying to refine the model, trying to understand, you know, how did we get to a 67% win rate, and how do we carry that forward into more than three states, right? And I mean, we're not a 50-state program, but I think we could easily be a 10 to 15-state program. There have to be the right demographics, there has to be the right civic engagement infrastructure, and there has to be enough political opportunity, right? So we're not going to go train folks in South Carolina or Idaho for mainly because there are just not enough political opportunities there. But I think in closing, I'll say something that I think is a bit of a follow-up to what you were saying, Julia, but also I think reflects the way that we do our work, the way that we train folks to think about their campaigning, but also their governance. And that is that you really can't have a policy conversation without first having a people conversation. And I think liberals, you know, are very quick to move to a policy conversation without first acknowledging where people are. You know, part of it is the where people are. But truthfully, most people are making decisions based on their own individual needs, right? And I'll just very quickly say, you know, I have an 11-year, almost 11-year-old daughter who the other day wanted to take over my Twitter account. And I said, listen, most people your age don't have a Twitter account because it's always the lobby about, you know. And she said, well, you know, most kids my age are not as politically engaged as I am. And because she knows the way to my heart. But the day after the election, when we woke her up and we told her what had happened, the first thing she said, and the reason I tell you the Twitter example is because she sees herself as a politically engaged child. But the first thing she said when she heard about the election was, is there anyone in our family who is going to be in danger? And so the purity of that question and that fear is really what dictates how most people make decisions, frankly, even us. And I think we tend to forget that when we get into our day jobs. And so, if, you know, that people over policy is really, I think, part of what we need to see and read about and part of and a lot of how we need to approach the conversation going forward.
First of all, with a thank you again to Carnegie, Open Society, Ford, and others who, New York Philanthropy, and others who made this event happen. I really am tremendously grateful. In closing, I would say that there's in every conversation that I did, in every interview that I did, I tried to close with one question. I would ask the person, you know, what gives you hope? And going back to South Carolina, I interviewed Norma Blanton, and she's a teacher at Arcadia Elementary School. And the school changed dramatically over the years, created a lot of tension in the community, but the school is really engaging in a very thoughtful way. I visited her during an after-school program for adults, and she knew practically every mother who went through who's in the building. So we're sitting in her office, and I asked her this question. I said, you know, so what gives you hope, Norma? And she pauses, and it was kind of coming out at the end of a really, really emotional conversation. And her eyes tear up, and she says, they keep coming back. The community keeps coming back. I left the project. I leave every day. I enter every day with a sense of hope because whether it's Norma in South Carolina or, you know, 75 dairymen in Idaho, they do want to engage in this conversation in a really, really constructive way. And we've got to figure out ways that allow it to make sense for them and allow their voices to be a part of the fray. In terms of sustaining this approach, I love New Yorkers, but just in the last couple of days, like, New Yorkers are just very insular. Same like San Francisco. It's like when I go to San Francisco and I talk to the tech community, I say, hey, when the voter in Kansas sees that you need another engineer, they don't see another engineer. They see another immigrant. So I think the sustainability strategy is really that foundations and others continue to kind of push out of the bubble.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and I'm just going to say one thing to say thank you to you all again. You excellent. Thank you, Julia, especially for giving us your great insights. We are, Ali's going to be actually here for the next few minutes to actually sign your books if you want them. Please take a book. They're free. Go as long as they last. And then, Joelle, you have the last word from the Roosevelt Institute.
All right, I'll be brief. I'm here on behalf of our CEO and President, Felicia Wong, who, as Ali mentioned, is in Canada. Otherwise, she would definitely be here, just a little bit far of a commute. So I just want to say thank you for this really, really insightful and thoughtful conversation. I really feel like we got beyond the headlines, and the kind of strategies that you've built have so much potential to be transformative because they really go beyond the headlines. They take into account, of course, the political climate, but also socio-political factors, culture, like you said, Sayu, people, right? And realities and how they can actually be a part of a broader movement for change. And so I was just very inspired by all the work and the conversation. So thank you.